Chapter 8, The Evidence of Symbiosis and Genetic Similarities.
The Vatican has issued a stout defense of Charles Darwin, voicing strong criticism of Christian fundamentalists who reject his theory of evolution and interpret the biblical account of creation literally. Cardinal Paul Poupard, head of the Pontifical Council for Culture, said the Genesis description of how God created the universe and Darwin's theory of evolution were perfectly compatible if the Bible were read correctly. Cardinal Poupard said that it was important for Catholic believers to know how science saw things so as to understand things better. His statements were interpreted in Italy as a rejection of the intelligent design view, which says the universe is so complex that some higher being must have designed every detail. The Vatican newspaper has published an article saying intelligent design is not science and that teaching it alongside evolutionary theory in school classrooms only creates confusion. The Vatican's chief astronomer, the Reverend George Coyne, also said that intelligent design wasn't science and had no place in school classrooms. And Vatican astronomer Guy Consolmagno said, believing that God created the universe in 6 days is a form of superstitious paganism. In fact, he described creationism, whose supporters want it taught in schools alongside evolution, as a kind of paganism because it harked back to the days of nature gods who were responsible for natural events.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I sure find it interesting how the Vatican, who mind you, says they're the voice piece of God, are actually saying what about God? They're saying we didn't come from an intelligent creator God but an evolutionary cosmic burp. They're actually backing evolution. Then they have the audacity to say that intelligent design is not only not science when the whole time all we've been dealing with is nothing but science, but they're actually calling it superstitious paganism. And they're supposed to represent God. People, that's not only ironic, it's outright dangerous. Why? Because what have we been seeing? Those who are suppressing the truth about God being the creator of all life are actually doing what? They're actually storing up the wrath of God. And how many of you would say that's probably not a good thing to do? Therefore, in order to help you and I to become the most effective witnesses we can for Jesus Christ and help these folks out, that's right, we're going to continue in our study called The Witness of Creation. And what we're doing is taking a look at the 5 different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with Him, the Creator of the universe. And the first evidence God left behind for us showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. And so far we've seen 6 evidences of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world, and that was the evidence of the universe, the evidence of the solar system, the evidence of the human body, the evidence of the animal kingdom, and then in the last chapter we saw how even the plant and bacteria kingdoms show evidence of God's intelligent design. And there we saw, gee whiz, anybody who's smarter than fish bait knows that the design in those plants and bacteria implies what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say that's probably speaking about God? But that's right, believe it or not, did you know that's not the only evidences of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world? The 7th evidence of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world is the evidence from symbiotic relationships. But hey, don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's.
Isaiah 11:1-9. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy, with justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea.
Now folks, according to our text, one of the neat characteristics of the millennial kingdom is not just that Jesus will literally be ruling and reigning over the entire earth, but the animals over the entire earth will be doing what? They won't be eating each other. Apparently, they'll be too busy playing and feeding with each other. Including the wolf and the lamb and the calf and the lion. If you did that today, what would you get? Lamb chops, right? But here in the millennial reign of Christ, that won't be the case. And here's my point. Notice the interesting side effect. It says there that when the animals neither harm nor destroy as we would expect, it's a sign of what? That the earth is full of the knowledge of God. But here's what's amazing. God has worked it out so that we don't have to wait until the millennial kingdom to know that He exists through positive animal relationships. The existence of God can be known through positive animal relationships today called symbiotic relationships. And for those of you who may not know, a symbiotic relationship is defined as a close ecological relationship between two or more kind of life forms that in most cases benefits both parties. And the reason why these kind of relationships lead to the knowledge of God is because when you see how these life forms are dependent upon each for existence, then it shows there's no way evolution could take place. Both organisms have to be there fully functioning at the same time in order to survive, and only a creator God could do that. Therefore, I'd say we better take a look at not just the scriptural evidence but the scientific evidence of these symbiotic relationships and see who's telling the truth. How about you?
Lock and key analogy. First of all, to understand the logic of why symbiotic relationships disprove evolution and actually prove creation, we need to think about the symbiotic relationship, if you will, between a lock and key. Let's say you're walking around one day and you just happen to find a metal key on the ground. So you pick it up and continue on your journey, but pretty soon you come upon an empty house just a few hundred yards from where you found the key. And since inquiring minds want to know, you decide to try to open the door of the empty house with the key you just found, and voila, it works. Thus, the logical conclusion you come to is that key was obviously designed to open that lock on this particular house, and both lock and key must have been made by the same craftsman, otherwise the door never would have opened. But what if someone popped out from behind the bushes who overheard your conclusion and said to you, "You're nuts. That key you found has no special relation to that lock, and it's purely coincidence that it even fits and works together in the first place." If someone actually said that to you, it would be totally illogical, right? Why? Because it would be ludicrous to think that that key not only has a complex design of ridges, but it just so happens that these ridges fit perfectly with the complex design of the lock. And this is precisely my point. So it is with symbiotic relationships. When you see two complex creatures fitting together like a lock and key, you do not assume that this occurred by means of an evolutionary chance encounter. Rather, you logically conclude that these creatures had to be designed by a master craftsman, especially when you see how their interrelationship is necessary for the survival of both parties. That is, they both have to be there fully functioning at the same time, or it spells certain doom. Now let's take a look at some specific examples.
The bees and flowers. For instance, how about the symbiotic relationship between bees and flowers? It just so happens that bees need food and flowers need some means to pollinate or reproduce, otherwise both would die. And it also just so happens that for some reason, bees know how to fly from flower to flower, gathering nectar, which is an obvious benefit to the bees. This is their food supply. Yet, when the bees land on a particular flower to get that food, they in turn get pollen stuck on their bodies, which then gets transferred to the next flower they land on, in effect pollinating it. This in turn is an obvious benefit to the flower. It now gets to reproduce. In short, this symbiotic relationship ensures the bees get to eat and the flowers get to reproduce. If the bees don't eat, they die, and if the flowers can't reproduce, they die. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? Did the flowers wait millions of years to reproduce until the bees too evolved and got busy pollinating the flowers so they can reproduce? Or did the bees refrain from eating for millions of years before flowers evolved in order to give them some food? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship right from the beginning? And if you think about it, this kind of symbiotic relationship between the bees and flowers adds proof for a literal six-day creation. The Bible says that the plants were created on the third day while the insects were created on the sixth day.
If these days aren't literal days, then how could either bees or flowers survive for millions of years?
Pollinating plants can survive for 3 days awaiting God's creation of the bees, but not for millions of years.
Yucca moth and yucca plant. Or how about the symbiotic relationship between the yucca moth and the yucca plant. It just so happens that both of them are totally dependent upon each other for survival. The yucca plant cannot pollinate itself to grow seeds, and the yucca moth needs a safe place to reproduce and feed its young. Well, it just so happens that the yucca moth not only pollinates the yucca plant, but wait until you hear the complex process it does it in. First, the moth begins by landing on the stamens of a yucca plant, and then proceeds to make a sticky ball of pollen. How did it know how and why to do that? Then, for some reason, it knows how to carry that sticky ball of pollen under its neck, which just so happens to come with an appendage under its neck to hold that sticky ball of pollen. And this appendage just so happens to be unique to this species of moth only. Then the yucca moth proceeds to take the sticky ball of pollen to another yucca plant, whereupon it somehow knows how to carefully insert the pollen inside the pistil stigma's tube at the top to ensure that the pollination of the plant is complete. Then the yucca moth proceeds to deposit its eggs there. And once the yucca moth's eggs are hatched, the larvae start to eat the seeds of the yucca plant. However, for some reason, in a display of amazing intelligence, the adult yucca moth knows to only lay a certain amount of eggs, so that the larvae will eat only some of the seeds, and not all of them, ensuring that the yucca plant will still get to reproduce. Thus the facts are this. If the yucca moth didn't perform this complex procedure, both would organisms would die. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start?
The plover bird and the crocodile. Another famous symbiotic relationship is between the Egyptian plover bird and the crocodile. The crocodile needs to get rid of potentially harmful parasites on its body, and the plover bird needs something to eat. Well, it just so happens that the plover bird is not only well known for preying on these particular parasites that feed on crocodiles, but the crocodile actually allows the plover bird to come on and into its body to remove them. Believe it or not, the plover bird first flies around the crocodile's head to catch its attention, and then the crocodile proceeds to not only allow the plover bird to hunt on the outside of its body, but it even opens its jaws to allow the bird to search for and eat the parasites inside its mouth, giving the crocodile a good teeth cleaning. This works out great for the crocodile, because he gets rid of the harmful parasites, and it also benefits the plover bird, because he not only gets a steady source of food, but a safe one, since no predator is going to bother the plover bird while it's on, in, or near the crocodile. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start?
The ant and the acacia tree. Or how about the symbiotic relationship between the ant and the acacia tree? It just so happens that the bullhorn acacia doesn't come equipped with the bitter alkaloids in its leaves that are needed to defend itself against potentially harmful insect attacks, thereby leaving it totally vulnerable. But it also just so happens that a particular ant decided to make its home in the thorns of the bullhorn acacia tree, thereby providing the much-needed defense for the tree. Believe it or not, like a tiny bodyguard, a particular ant actually protects the acacia tree from harmful insects, animals, or humans that may come into contact with it by releasing an alarm pheromone. Once this is released into the air, a horde of ants rush out en masse and come to the aid of the tree. In fact, animals can actually smell this pheromone and will thus generally avoid these acacia trees at all costs. But even if animals do try to chew on the leaves of the acacia tree, the ants will proceed to sting the animal's mouth and tongue, forcing it to stop. But that's not all. The ants even perform maintenance for this tree. They also clear away seedlings and other plants that try to grow around the base of the acacia tree that might otherwise grow up and block out the much needed sunlight for the tree. So how does the tree pay back the ant for its service? Well, believe it or not, the tree actually rewards the ant with protein nodules called Belthian bodies from its leaflet tips, as well as carbohydrate-rich nectar from the glands on its leaf stalk. And what's even more amazing is the fact that these Belthian bodies have no known function other than to simply provide food for the ants. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start? The plovebird and the crocodile. Another famous symbiotic relationship is between the Egyptian plovebird and the crocodile. The crocodile needs to get rid of potentially harmful parasites on its body, and the plovebird needs something to eat. Well, it just so happens that the plovebird is not only well known for preying on these particular parasites that feed on crocodiles, but the crocodile actually allows the plovebird to come on and into its body to remove them. Believe it or not, the plovebird first flies around the crocodile's head to catch its attention, and then the crocodile proceeds to not only allow the plovebird to hunt on the outside of its body, but it even opens its jaws to allow the bird to search for and eat the parasites inside its mouth, giving the crocodile a good teeth cleaning. This works out great for the crocodile because he gets rid of the harmful parasites, and it also benefits the plovebird because he not only gets a steady source of food, but a safe one since no predator is going to bother the plovebird while it's on, in, or near the crocodile. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start?
The ant and the acacia tree. Or how about the symbiotic relationship between the ant and the acacia tree? It just so happens that the bullhorn acacia doesn't come equipped with the bitter alkaloids in its leaves that are needed to defend itself against potentially harmful insect attacks, thereby leaving it totally vulnerable. But it also just so happens that a particular ant decided to make its home in the thorns of the bullhorn acacia tree, thereby providing the much-needed defense for the tree. Believe it or not, like a tiny bodyguard, a particular ant actually protects the acacia tree from harmful insects, animals, or humans that may come into contact with it by releasing an alarm pheromone. Once this is released into the air, a horde of ants rush out en masse and come to the aid of the tree. In fact, animals can actually smell this pheromone and will thus generally avoid these acacia trees at all costs. But even if animals do try to chew on the leaves of the acacia tree, the ants will proceed to sting the animal's mouth and tongue, forcing it to stop. But that's not all. The ants even perform maintenance for this tree. They also clear away seedlings and other plants that try to grow around the base of the acacia tree that might otherwise grow up and block out the much-needed sunlight for the tree. So how does the tree pay back the ant for its service? Well, believe it or not, the tree actually rewards the ant with protein nodules called Belthian bodies from its leaflet tips, as well as carbohydrate-rich nectar from the glands on its leaf stalk. And what's even more amazing is the fact that these Belthian bodies have no known function other than to simply provide food for the ants. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start?
The clownfish and the anemone. Another amazing example of an intelligently designed symbiotic relationship is between the clownfish and the sea anemone. It just so happens that the sea anemone is equipped with potent stingers but is still nonetheless in danger of being eaten from various fish, and thus sure could use some extra effective protection. Well, it also just so happens that the clownfish is unfortunately an easy-to-spot brightly colored fish with poor swimming abilities that sure could use a safe place to live. And wonder of wonder, it just so happens that these two creatures actually work brilliantly together to ensure the survival of both. First, the sea anemone not only lets the clownfish live in and or around it, but it even goes so far as to protect the clownfish with its stingers from other fish trying to eat the clownfish.
But wait a second. What about the clownfish?
Does it get harmed by the potent stingers?
Nope.
It just so happens that the clownfish, unlike other fish, come designed with a special slimy mucus that just so happens to protect it from the stings of the sea anemone, making the normally dangerous environment a very safe one to now live in. And in turn for this well-guarded home, the clownfish not only defends and protects the sea anemone from other fish trying to eat it, but the clownfish will actually feed and take care of it as well. It has actually been observed how the clownfish will take a piece of food, chew it up and spit it into the sea anemone's tentacles, effectively feeding it. And once this relationship between the two has been established, the clownfish will never stray away from the sea anemone of a distance of more than 6 to 12 inches for an entire lifetime. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve?
Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship right from the start?
The goby fish and the shrimp. Another example of an amazing symbiotic relationship is between the goby fish and the shrimp. It just so happens that the shrimp has a serious problem. It's almost totally blind, leaving it an easy prey to predators. And it also just so happens that the goby fish needs a safe place to live and lay its eggs from its dangerous predators. Well, believe it or not, the goby fish and shrimp not only live together peacefully, but they work together beautifully for survival. Believe it or not, the shrimp will not only dig a burrow in the sand for both shrimp and fish to live in, but it will actually clean and maintain it. And in turn for this home, the goby fish actually rewards the shrimp with protection. It has been observed that when a predator comes around, the goby fish will actually touch the shrimp with its tail to warn it, and both shrimp and goby immediately go into the burrow to hide for safety. In fact, they always keep in close contact with each other, touching each other, the goby using its tail and the shrimp with its antenna. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship right from the start?
Tube worms and bacteria. Yet another incredibly designed symbiotic relationship is between the tube worm and bacteria. Tube worms live at the bottom of the ocean at extreme depths, some as far as a mile deep, and thus have a problem. Being at the bottom of the ocean, they are far away from the sun, thus cannot use and convert the light of the sun as do other organisms for energy. Then, if that wasn't bad enough, the tube worm starts off with a digestive tract, but then loses it during metamorphosis. So how can and does the tube worm survive in these conditions? Well, it just so happens that these tube worms, some of which can grow as long as 8 feet long, have a bacteria inside of one of their internal organs called the trophosome. And it just so happens that this bacteria has the ability to turn the elements at the bottom of the ocean, oxygen, hydrogen sulfide, and carbon dioxide, into organic molecules that the tube worm can then eat. So how does the tube worm reward the bacteria for saving its life? Believe it or not, the tube worm will actually use its plumes to gather the necessary nutrients needed for the bacteria to eat. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship right from the start?
Intestinal bacteria and humans. One of the most amazing and granted gross examples of a God-given symbiotic relationship is between humans and the bacteria found in our intestines. In fact, there are anywhere from 300 to 1,000 different species of bacteria living inside our guts. As gross as it sounds, we desperately need them for survival. You see, it just so happens we have a problem. We need help digesting our food, which otherwise would be instantly fatal. And it just so happens that certain bacteria need a well-protected environment and a rich supply of food. Well, believe it or not, it just so happens that our intestines not only contain bacteria, but the right kind of bacteria that enables us to digest our food safely, as well as convert that food into healthy vitamins. Believe it or not, most of the mass in the colon, and 60% of our internal waste products, are made up of valuable bacteria. They are not just taking up space, they are in there fermenting unused energy substrates, training the immune system, preventing the growth of harmful bacteria, regulating the development of the gut, producing the much-needed vitamins such as biotin and vitamin K, stimulating cell growth, defending against certain diseases, and producing the hormones needed for storing fats. But that's only half of the story. Just where do all these vital bacteria come from? Well, believe it or not, it's all part of God's designed program for our survival. During and after the birthing process, the bacteria begins getting transferred from within the mother from the umbilical cord, the placenta, and even the surrounding environment, and into the newborn baby. Then after birthing process, other needed bacteria continues to get transferred into the baby via the contents of the breast milk, from suckling, and the kissing and caressing of the mother. No wonder we need a mother's tender nurturing care. So the next time your mom licks her thumb to get that jelly off your face, you should be very thankful. In fact, it has been shown that tweaking with the numbers of bacteria within your gut, like taking antibiotics, can actually cause serious bodily harm. Yes, taking antibiotics can and does kill certain bacteria illnesses, but it can also unintentionally destroy the good bacteria in your gut. So the logical question is, how could evolution ever explain this kind of relationship? How could either of these organisms survive millions of years waiting for the other one to evolve? Or wouldn't it be more logical to say that an intelligent creator designed their intelligent relationship, right from the start?
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say those symbiotic relationships clearly show, they not only were but they had to be intelligently designed by an intelligent creator, how about you? In fact, I'd say anybody who says they weren't, they're acting like they're missing a few buttons on their remote control. You know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, I guess that's why Henry Schaefer, Graham Purdue Professor of Chemistry and Director of the Center for Computational Quantum Chemistry at the University of Georgia, said.
The significance and joy in my science comes in those occasional moments of discovering something new and saying to myself, so that's how God did it. My goal is to understand a little corner of God's plan.
Krohn translation? If you think all of life, including those symbiotic relationships, were created by chance, you're acting like you're missing a few buttons on your remote control. Right? Isn't that what he's saying? Of course he is. Why? Because any intelligent person knows that design implies a what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say that when it comes to life it had to be God? Hey, great answer, you're so intelligent. Oh, but that's not all. The eighth evidence of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world is the evidence of genetic similarities. And for those of you who may not know, genetic similarities are those general occurrences where we observe certain similarities between various life forms. Such as some having similar limb structures, or some having similar protein makeup, or some having similar genetic composition. And the problem with genetic similarities is that evolutionists will take one look at these common characteristics and conclude, voila, we have proof for evolution, because these similarities prove a common origin. But actually, the irony is, once you look at these common characteristics, they actually do just the opposite. They actually prove the existence of a common designer, i.e. God. And in order to help us understand the problem of evolutionists coming to this faulty conclusion of genetic similarities proving evolution when in reality, they prove creationism, let's observe this guy's faulty conclusion.
One day, a farmer was pulling a calf out that was a breech birth with the feet coming out first. So the farmer was using the calf puller with a winch wrapped around the legs of the calf to jack the calf out of the cow. Well, a city slicker was driving by and stopped to see what was going on because he had never seen anything like this before. He stood there staring over the fence, and the farmer said, "Hey, come here. Give me some help." The city slicker said, "Who, me?" The farmer said, "Yes. Hurry, come here. I need some help." So the city slicker got out of his car, jumped over the fence, and ran over to help the farmer pull the calf. He never said a word during the ordeal. He just did what he was told. Well, about 10 minutes later they were walking up to the barn to get washed up, and the farmer said, "I want to thank you for helping me. I really appreciate it." The city slicker said, "That's fine, no problem, no problem." The farmer said, you've been awfully quiet. Are you okay? The city slicker says, oh yeah, I'm okay. The farmer said, have you ever seen anything like that before? The city slicker said, no sir, I've never seen anything like that in my entire life. The farmer said, well, do you have any questions? The city slicker said, yes sir, I do. It's been bothering me the whole time that we were out there pulling that calf. The farmer said, well, what's your question? The city slicker said, how fast do you figure that calf was going when it ran into that cow?
Now folks, what was wrong with that guy's conclusion? They weren't separating a wreck. That cow was giving birth, right? And this is a prime example of two people observing the same thing yet one of them comes to the wrong conclusion. And so it is with evolutionists and genetic similarities. They see these similar characteristics in life forms and say here's proof of a common evolutionary origin when in reality they prove a common designer. Just how fast was that calf going anyway? Therefore, I'd say we better take a look at the scientific evidence of genetic similarities and see who's got the right conclusion.
Similar limbs. For instance, evolutionists would say that since various animals have similar front limb structures, that this points to a common evolutionary origin. Even in textbooks today, they will show pictures of the fingers, wrist, and arm bones of the human, ape, whale, bat, bird, and horse that do indeed show similarities in design. But this still doesn't mean that they all had a common ancestor. It could mean that these similarities in limb structures simply point to the evidence of an intelligent creator designing life forms using similar patterns.
Just how fast was that calf going anyway?
In fact, we see this same occurrence of design similarities in automobile engineers today. Did you know that a Cadillac engine can fit in a Chevy? Now does that prove they both evolved from a skateboard 12 million years ago?
I don't think so.
Or did you know that the lug nuts on a Pontiac also fit on a Chevy? So does that mean they both evolved from a Honda 14 million years ago?
I don't think so.
It just means that engineers used similar design patterns in their automobile parts.
That's all.
And similar limb structures only show that God used similar design structure in organisms to get the job done.
Similar protein. Or, there's the example of evolutionists saying that since bird feathers and scales are both made from a similar substance, keratin, which is true, that this proves that feathers evolved from dinosaur scales. Now, wait a second. Just how fast was that calf going anyway? First of all, feathers and scales are vastly different, but yes, they are made from the same protein called keratin. But so are our fingernails and hair, but that doesn't prove that one evolved from the other. This would be applying the same faulty logic if you said that since battleships and forks are both made out of the same metal, iron, that they must have evolved from a tin can 27 million years ago. I don't think so. Therefore, similar protein only shows that God used similar ingredients in organisms to get the job done. That's all.
Similar DNA. Or another wrong conclusion evolutionists come to in the issue of similarities in various organisms, is in the area of the similarities of the DNA structure. They say that evolution is true because the percentage of similar DNA sequencing shows that all of life is related. Then they go so far as to arrange all the animals in order, based on their DNA similarities, as a supposed chart as to how evolution occurred.
But wait a second. How fast was that calf going anyway?
Couldn't this similar DNA structure once again prove that a common designer was once again using common parts and plans to get the job done?
Sounds intelligent to me.
But probably one of the most common faulty conclusions of DNA similarities that the evolutionists use is between apes and humans. They tell us that since apes and humans are 98% similar in their DNA structure, that this is proof that we had a common ancestor 15 million years ago.
But hold on. Once again, how fast was that calf going anyway? This doesn't prove evolution. It proves we have a common designer.
Similar DNA codes simply prove that the same engineer wrote the codes. For instance, it is likely that much of the software that comes out of Microsoft has a high degree of similarities in their programs. So does that mean they evolved from Morse code 43 million years ago? No. It just means that the same guys are writing the programs using similar codes. Besides, when it comes to the relationship between apes and humans, there are thousands and thousands of differences. Yet, The evolutionists point out this one similarity of the DNA structure and somehow think this is proof of evolution. But what they don't tell you is that Dr. Barney Maddox, a leading genetic genome researcher, blew the lid off of this myth concerning man/ape genetic similarities when he said this. The genetic difference between human and his supposed nearest relative, the chimpanzee, is at least 1.6%. That doesn't sound like much, but calculated out, that is a gap of at least 48 million nucleotides, and a change of only 3 nucleotides is fatal to an animal. There is no possibility of change. In fact, a writer for the Smithsonian admitted this in this statement: just a few percentage points can translate into vast, unbridgeable gaps between species. The difference is now known to be 5%, not 1.6%. Thus, even the evolutionists admit that rather than proving evolution, similar DNA structure, even as high as 98%, actually disproves evolution. It shows that it could never happen in the first place, no matter how much time you give it. Therefore, once you look at the facts, genetic similarities actually end up proving a common designer. How fast was that calf going anyway? In fact, one scientist stated, similar structures nearly always have similar plans, DNA in this case. Similar bridges have similar blueprints. This hardly constitutes evidence that one sired the other, or that they were erected by tornadoes.
People, the facts are this. If there were not some similarities between us and other animals, then we could only eat each other. So God designed all animals from the same code so that we could eat other plants and animals and digest them. And I don't know about you, but I'm glad God designed it that way. Besides, if you want to just pick one item and say that's supposed to prove an evolutionary relationship, did you know that when it comes to DNA similarities, that man is only 11% different from a duck? Now I know a lot of people who act a little quacky, but that doesn't mean they were hatched from a duck. Or did you know that we share about 50% of our DNA with bananas? Now again, I know people can act bananas, but that doesn't make them one. Or did you know that human cytochrome C is closest to a sunflower? So apparently the sunflowers are our closest relatives. Yeah, right. Or if you compare eyes, did you know that the octopus has closest eye to ours? Not a chimpanzee. An octopus. Or how about blood? The specific gravity of human blood is closest to a rabbit or a pig. We may act like pigs, but we didn't come from one. Or did you know that human milk is closest to that of a donkey? Or cholesterol level tests indicate that the garter snake is man's closest relative. Or on the basis of another type of blood chemistry test, the butter bean is man's closest relative. And finally, believe it or not, apparently the similarities of tear enzyme chemistry indicate that the chicken is man's closest relative. Now that is evil. Thus, as you can see, similarities not only disprove evolution and instead prove creationism, but they can be used to create just about any kind of imaginary evolutionary process. And just to show you how goofy this evolutionary similarity game really is, and how you can use it to prove just about anything you want, let's listen to the comical results of this guy's research.
Folks, complex things require a designer. If you think the percentage of similarity proves something, let me show you the research I've been doing. I've discovered that clouds are 100% water and watermelons are 97% water. There's only a 3% difference. That proves watermelons evolved from clouds. And I discovered that jellyfish are 98% water and so are snow cones. That proves how they evolved. Or did you know that penicillin only has 2 chromosomes? But fruit flies have 8. So I put together some critters and you know, I think I know how evolution really happened. Penicillin was first, then it evolved into a fruit fly. Then it evolved into a tomato because it has 12 chromosomes, or a housefly, it has 12 as well. It's very hard to tell the difference between these two. Then slowly over millions of years, they got some more chromosomes and became a pea, which has 14 chromosomes. And then it evolved into a bee, which has 16 chromosomes. Now here you can see the similarity. P, B, very similar. And very slowly it evolved into lettuce with 18 chromosomes. And over millions of years, finally triplets were born. Did you know the opossum, redwood tree, and kidney bean all have 22 chromosomes? The average scientist cannot tell them apart. And then slowly over millions of years it evolved into a human with 46 chromosomes. And if we can get just 2 more chromosomes, we're going to be a tobacco plant. Sometimes I'll get on the elevator and sniff the person next to me and say, "Man, you're evolving. You're way ahead of me." And of course, dogs and chickens are twins. Everybody knows that because they both have 78 chromosomes. But someday, we might get enough chromosomes to be a carp. It has 100. And it probably won't happen in my lifetime, but maybe we'll evolve far enough to someday stardate 349572, we can become a fern with 480 chromosomes. I was in a church service one time, and this lady came to me afterwards, and shook my hand and said to me, "I'm Fern." I shook hands with her with my right hand. I'll never wash it again.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say that genetic similarities clearly show that we not only were but we had to be intelligently designed by an intelligent creator. How about you? In fact, I'd say anybody who says they weren't, they're acting like their antenna doesn't pick up all the channels, you know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, apparently that's why Paul Davis, British astrophysicist, said this.
There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming.
Crone translation? If you think all of life, including those genetic similarities, were created by chance, then you're acting like your antenna doesn't pick up all the channels. Right? Isn't that what he's saying? Of course he is. Why? Because any intelligent person knows that design implies a what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say when it comes to life it had to be God? Hey, great answer, you're so intelligent. Oh, but that's not all. The ninth evidence of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world is the evidence from logic. People, we're going to take a look at common sense logic, and you tell me with your own brain if there's any way life could have ever evolved. But we'll take a look at that in the next chapter.